There's a big question about our future that no one's talking about.
Right now, we're likely to set the stage for how the future is going to unfold for our species, and almost no one cares at all about this.
What happens when technology catches us and then passes us by? I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. It's called the technology singularity, the moment, which experts say is fast approaching, when our technology is faster, better, and smarter than we are. What will that mean to our economy, our society, our lives? At the front of the discussion is Google engineer Ray Kurzweil, whose latest book is The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. Is this all news to you? This week, we found a great interview on the Grox Science Show with Professor James Miller of Smith College, who spoke about the impact of the singularity.
Our entire civilization from human brains, I mean, we're a bit smarter than chimps, and we've used that intelligence to get everything we have. Well, the singularity asks you to envision what would happen if we create people or machines that are smarter than we are today. What might they give us? What might they take from us? Every year, the amount of computing power you can buy per dollar about doubles. Now, right now, even the best computers, they're not as fast as the human brain. But it's likely, certainly within the century, that even a personal computer that you could get will be smarter than you are. And we're also working on creating software that would give artificial intelligence agents that would make them smarter than people. And what would happen if, for example, your employer could replace you with a computer program that costs $100?
So what's really the timeline?
I'm not sure. I mean, it could happen as soon as the next decade, or it might take a century. It also partially depends on how we get a singularity. One possible path, I think, is through genetics, where we figure out the genetic basis of intelligence and we make each generation a lot smarter than the one before. That would take quite a while to occur. Another path is someone, maybe today Google, figures out how to create a really intelligent computer. And that computer quickly designs better and better software. So maybe in that scenario, we get a singularity in the next 5 years.
So given these different possible routes to the singularity, and what then do you think are the economic impacts of singularity rising?
Sure. Well, there's a whole bunch of them. A big one that we touched on before is that if we have machines that are a lot smarter than people, then it would be very hard for most people to earn very much wealth through their labor. Now, fortunately, a singularity would likely make us very rich, so the value of our stock portfolio could go up 1,000 times, but still we wouldn't be able to earn very much in the marketplace. Another scenario, though, is that we create computers that really don't have much use for us. These computers are as above us as we are from chimpanzees, and just as we're quite willing to take, the land chimpanzees live on and leave them for dead, they'll do the same for us. And then another scenario, this is one Ray Kurzweil writes about, where we actually merge with artificial intelligences. So every year we get better brain implants and we become smarter and smarter and more productive, and we all become extraordinarily rich and healthy, and we live in basically a utopia. So there's a lot of different scenarios, and things could go horribly wrong or go extraordinarily well for us. It all comes down to how we end up managing these intelligence-enhancing technologies. Competition is likely to push us to a singularity, even if most people don't want it to happen. Because you can imagine if, the U.S. military decides not to worry about intelligence enhancements, but the Chinese do, well, then the Chinese will become the dominant military power. And the same with companies. If one group of hedge funds decides to have their analysts use the latest technologies and have brain implants in them while other hedge funds don't, then the ones that have the smartest employees will be the ones that dominate the marketplace. So because intelligence is so important to winning economic or military competitions, we're impersonal market forces are going to be pushing us to make ourselves and our machines a lot smarter than they are now.
So do you still envision a place for patients such as manufacturing?
I think designing of products, there'll be a role for humans for a while. But no, I think the actual physical making of the good, we're likely to continue on our trend where people are doing less and less of it. I mean, even now, you see we're starting to see the rise of three-dimensional printing, where just as today you can go to the internet and download a song, I imagine in a few years you'll be able to download a razor blade, and eventually you might even be able to download whole automobiles. So we're going to get manufacturing is going to become a form of software. The best way to prepare, I would say, is to make sure that if we do create super intelligent machines, that they're friendly towards us. I mean, we're, you know, right now, mankind, we're by far the smartest species on the planet, and we are, you know, we're not very nice to other creatures. So what we should be doing is devoting a lot of resources to figure out what would it mean for a computer to be friendly to us. The computer, it will have software that tells us how to behave, but what would it mean to instill friendliness in software? And is this even possible? Let's hope that it is. So I know there's one organization called the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence, and they are trying to get people who are really, really good at math to come up with some general principles for what it would mean to create a friendly artificial intelligence. And let's hope we can figure out friendliness before we have these, you know, super beings, basically, that can do whatever they want to us.
Do you think those who are developing this technology really are aware of these, I think, moralistic kind of issues in terms of designing the technology?
I think they are at least aware of them. I don't know how seriously they take them. I mean, Ray Kurzweil is a very big player in the technology market, and I know he's friends with Bill Gates, who has endorsed Kurzweil's book. At the Singularity Institute, they have conferences, and they have a lot of serious high-tech people involved in it. So I think most of the major names in the technology field are aware of the danger, and I don't know how much resources they're putting into trying to create friendly artificial intelligence, but at least they're not completely unaware of the problem.
So do you think the future of the singularity makes humans obsolete, or what do you think our place will be economically, societally, all aspects of life?
Well, there is a good chance that we will be obsolete, at least as economic agents, that there'll be computers that can do things better than we ever could. Now, in some ways, this could be great, because we could have these robots that are creating lots and lots of wealth, and we get to consume it. We could still have meaningful lives. We could raise children. We could create art. We could build things if we want to for fun. Another scenario, though, is that we have the Kurzweilian scenario, where we merge with computers, and we become extraordinarily smart, and we're able to do a lot of things now that we couldn't before. So it's really, I think there's a lot of uncertainty as to how we'll reach the singularity. There could be sort of technologies that we're unaware of. It could be that it's extremely easy, for example, to merge the human brain with computers, and we just don't quite know how to do that yet, but in a decade we'll see, oh yeah, this is easy, and that'll be the path. Or it might be right now there's some Chinese organizations that are they're looking at the DNA of some really smart people, and they're trying to figure out what causes you to be a genius. It might be that they'll crack that, and in 10 years there'll start being a lot of babies born in China that are smarter than Einstein ever was, and that'll be a path that leads us to a singularity. Or there are pharmaceutical companies, in part to fight Alzheimer's disease, that are creating drugs to make us a lot smarter, and maybe we'll get these drugs fairly quickly, and these will lead us to, you know, tremendous intelligence enhancements.
Do you think that the singularity is an inevitable outcome, or do you think there are things that might prevent the singularity from occurring?
I think it's inevitable unless our high-tech society collapses. And certainly a war or a devastating plague, you know, send us back to the Stone Age, that could postpone or terminate the singularity. But otherwise, yeah, I think it's almost certain that we would reach it. And that's just because the potential for computers have the potential of being so much faster than our brain. I mean, the human brain basically is a computer, but it's run on meat, and we know that computers have the potential to process information far faster than our brains do. We also know that people like Albert Einstein, you know, they were real. And so it should be possible to tinker with genetics so that everyone is at the level of Einstein or maybe even much above him. So it should, I think it's almost certain that if we knew how, we could create people or machines much smarter than we have today. And they would almost certainly give us something fantastic, at least if we survive the experience. The main issue is that the kind of singularity we're going to get will determine our future. It'll determine whether our grandchildren, you know, die quickly or get to live, you know, forever in utopia almost. And so right now we're likely to set the stage for basically how the future is going to unfold for our species. And this should be the most important issue. And almost no one cares at all about this.
This interview with Professor James Miller of Smith College comes to us courtesy of the Grok Science Show. His book is called Singularity Rising. Want to see all the latest advances, good and questionable? Check out KurzweilAI.net and grokscience.wordpress.com.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Coming up, wearable technology, plus what artists are doing in response to the rise of drones. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% Archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1278. Fingerless gloves are back because we need our fingertips to use our smartphones. What else is happening in fashion that's really about technology?
On the surface, it's just like any other tech conference. People are exchanging business cards, drinking lots of coffee, and constantly checking their phones. But they're not just checking phones.
I'm wearing Geiger Counter's Fitbit Flex and Nike Fuel Band and a camera that I drag around with me and take pictures of stuff all over the place.
They're dressed like this because it's the Launch Wearable Tech Conference. That's right, wearable tech. And we're not just talking Google Glass.
We built a subwoofer for your headphones. It vibrates on your back so that you hear the low-end frequencies, but the people standing next to you can't hear a thing. You need to try it.
I sure do.
So basically, you wear it like a vest.
Okay. He's strapping this around my shoulder. Okay. So we're plugging my headphones into this, like, battery pack.
There's some music playing. You will hear that in your headphones now.
I can feel vibrations all along my back as electronic music is pumping in my headphones. For just a moment, I feel like I'm at Burning Man. Or maybe like I am Burning Man.
Now you on the radio, you have to see the expression. This is amazing. This is what we're going for.
Can you describe the expression on my face?
It's a look of pure bliss.
Wearable technology isn't technically new. The year 1975 brought us the Pulsar calculator watch.
The world's first solid-state wrist-time computer, now with date command, to read out the month and day, indicate morning and night.
1979, the Sony Walkman came on the scene, and people could suddenly wear their music wherever they went.
Sony introduces the only cassette player as small as a cassette case, the incredible-sounding Super Walkman.
But now, most wearable tech isn't just for entertainment. Instead, it's for tracking, and the subject is you. This phenomenon even has a name, the quantified self.
I think that in a few years, it'll be unthinkable, it'll be ridiculous to think back a few years when we had no information on our body. We didn't know how our body state, our sleep patterns, our emotional patterns, our heart, how it was doing in the moment.
That's Nadeem Kassam. He's the founder of a wearable health monitor company called Basis. He's a big believer that all this tracking will help us change our health and lifestyle habits, and that it won't seem weird for long.
You know, just a few years ago, it would be almost ridiculous to think that we would have an incredible supercomputer in our pocket that would connect us to anyone at any time or any piece of information on the planet in the moment. Now we all have iPhones.
Kassam shows me the Basis band. It looks like a soft rubber watch, but on the back, there's a bunch of small silver sensors that track things like your heart rate, your temperature, how many steps you take a day, how much you sweat. Right now, it's a way to monitor your workout. But Kassam tells me that in the future, we'll be able to measure our emotions with these sweat sensors. Of course I want to try it out.
Wow, your heart rate's escalated because I just put a body monitor on you.
Yeah, I'm really nervous what you're going to reveal.
I'm also touching your wrist.
Am I lying right now?
I'm also touching your wrist. And so it's calibrating on you. It'll go up and down. Immediately as you bring attention to it, it'll go up. You're oscillating around, your heartbeat is around 68, 69, 70.
Now, knowing your heart rate and how many calories you burn in a day, by itself, that probably isn't going to change your life. But plug into an app that shows you patterns in your habits over time, and the quantified self promises that the truth will set you free. Still, there's something uncomfortable about it. Google CEO Eric Schmidt famously said that the company's policy is to get right up to the creepy line and not cross it. Wearable tech makes that line a little blurrier.
These things are very creepy, they invade people's personal space, and they really interfere with intimacy.
That's Jason Calacanis, founder of the conference. He describes himself as a techno-optimist, but that doesn't mean he thinks all wearable tech is good.
We have to figure out if it's adding to our lives or taking away, and frequently it's doing both concurrently. And these wearable computers, because they're persistently on and they're persistently in a position to be taking video and audio, are massive offenders.
Calacanis tells me about a gadget called Narrative, a life-logging camera. It's a small, square, brooch-like tile you wear clipped to the front of your shirt or jacket, with a hole in the corner for a camera lens. It takes a photo every 30 seconds, and it's always on.
So are you taking photos of me right now?
I am, if that's okay. Yeah, so it looks like...
I'm standing across from Narrative founder Martin Schulstrom, who is sporting a Narrative as we talk. It's okay that he's recording me, because I'm also recording him with my mic. But in everyday life, even he admits that the camera is controversial. He still argues it's really useful in special cases, though.
Someone emailed us to say that her father came back from the Iraq war with a memory loss, so he can form new memories, and that they can include him in the dinner discussions about what they did during the day.
Schulstrom's argument is that wearing a camera is less disruptive than taking out a camera and pointing it at something every time you want to capture a moment. But I like to opt into my experiences and make a choice about whether or not they're documented, because once they're documented, they're not necessarily private. Personal data has a way of getting out. But before I put my tinfoil hat on, I find Sean Bonner. He works for Safecast, an organization that started mapping radiation levels and building sensor networks after the earthquake and nuclear crisis in Fukushima, Japan.
It was really started as a reaction to either government or industry kind of failing to provide that data. And so the community sort of stepping up to take care of those problems and provide a solution.
Bonner is wearing all black and is holding a bag full of devices with their wiry guts exposed. Cables, circuit boards, and knobs, like a radio in a see-through case. These are wearable Geiger counters, made to check radioactivity.
People take them and attach them to their bikes or backpacks when they go hiking, or just kind of carry them around in a bag all day and then collect that data, and then they can publish back and show what sort of levels they were exposed to during the day and provide that data for other people as well.
This was some wearable tech I could get behind, so I tried the Geiger counter around my wrist.
So it's reading the whole area around?
Yeah, exactly, and so there's a lot of stuff flying through this sensor all the time.
Like what kind of stuff?
No, like radiation particles, like alpha, beta, and gamma particles are flying through this all the time.
Okay, so I can't say,
yeah.
For KLW, I'm Christina Loring, and
right.
I'm not radioactive.
No, you are radioactive. Everything's radioactive.
You heard the man. In San Francisco, I'm radioactive Christina Loring for Cross Currents.
Drones are one of the hottest topics in technology today. Amazon's planning to use them to deliver our online orders. As Eric Molinsky discovered, some fine artists are incorporating drones into their artwork and dance performances.
It's Friday afternoon. I'm deep into Brooklyn at one of those art studios that used to be a factory.
Hey, Adam.
Hey, come on up.
Thanks.
Surveillance and privacy are big themes in Adam Harvey's artwork. That's why he likes to keep an eye on military blogs. Recently, he became fascinated with thermal imaging, which is how drone pilots see the world.
Okay, so if you look at thermal images, they're black and white, and the warm parts of you are white, and the cool parts are black.
That's how drones find people, looking for heat signatures.
And the tip of your nose will be a little bit darker than your face because it's always a little bit cooler. And it's not a flattering image by any means.
But that gave Adam an idea. What if you could design a piece of clothing that made a person invisible to drones?
This is silver metallized fabric.
He went through like 50 different fabrics until he found the right combination of wearability and heat retention.
Okay, here's the anti-drone hijab.
Yep. He designed them in the shape of hijabs and burqas. They're very shiny. No one would mistake this for desert camouflage. But he showed me a thermal image of a woman wearing a stealthwear hijab. And her head and shoulders are completely blacked out.
Black blends into the background, yeah.
Right now, they're expensive prototypes. Eventually, he hopes to have them made to order, because he says stealthwear is armor for the information age. And if a burqa isn't your style, he designed a stealthwear hoodie.
Hey. We're in the middle of a war, and that war is taking place abroad, but it's also taking place here in the form of surveillance. So everyone is walking this new battlefield physically and digitally.
A number of artists are creating works about drones these days, but Alex Rivera and his friend Angel Navarez were way ahead of the curve.
We were able to sense the drone was coming because we were connected to the border.
He means the border with Mexico.
The border is the first place in the U.S. homeland, so-called, where the drones are deployed. And so I think artists working in the border zone are almost like time travelers. We can see the future of what's going to come.
Back in 2005, they were reading about Border Patrol vigilantes flying homemade drones long before the U.S. government. They wondered, what would a Mexican drone look like? The first image that came to mind was a flying lowrider car.
We gave it all a gold flake and chrome paint job. The rotors were candy color and sparkliness, and you never see on a drone, right? The drones are always painted this matte gray with a paint that reflects radar.
They flew their low drone across the border back and forth, spliced together the footage, and then put a fake remote control on their website.
It feels like completely plausible. Oh, I know I'm in New York City, but I'm controlling this machine in Tijuana, and why not?
They're fun. To experience the state of the art, I met up with Danny Saltero at MIT in Cambridge. He builds drones that can swim, crawl, and fly. A few years back, Danny got this strange call from his boss. She said a dance company in New York called Palabolas wanted to develop a show between their dancers and his drones.
We just went inside a big room and they just told us, okay, just start flying around and we'll sort of take notes.
We started out by saying, what do they do?
Itamar Kabovi runs the dance company.
We said, could you land it on our head? Could you land it on the floor? Could you land it on our nose? Before too long, the choreographers were making engineering suggestions, and the engineers were making choreographic suggestions as to how to tell the story.
They ended up creating a show called Seraph. It's about two species that discover each other, one metal, the other flesh. The sets and costumes are very minimal, and seeing a man on a dark stage confronted by drones, it's hard not to think about Pakistan or Afghanistan.
At the same time, we don't want to nail those associations down too specifically. Because if you nail them down too specifically, it starts to become like a cautionary tale about Afghanistan. And I think especially when you're using dance and sort of metaphoric movement, that can be pretty embarrassing pretty quickly.
The dancer in the piece actually told us that the two different quadrilaters in the piece had different personalities that sort of reflected what the two pilots' personality was. So that was really surprising. But then you actually, when you think about it, it makes sense.
New technologies can seem creepy at first, but drones are just another way to extend what we already want to do. See the world from really high up, bring stuff to people really quickly, and sometimes kill our enemies in hard-to-reach places. The day will come when we'll wonder how we ever got along without them.
If we wanted to say, like, oh, hey, or nice to meet you, we would sort of just, like, wiggle it.
Yeah, can you make it land in my hand?
Sure.
Oh, it's a good little robot. Oh, it's a good little robot. Yeah.
Woo! There he goes.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining me. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.